Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing iron deficiency in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. This podcast is sponsored by Viatris. The views expressed in this podcast belong to the guest speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Viatris. My special guest is Dr. Sam Hurd, the Medical Director of the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress and an academic GP. Dr. Hurd, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Sam.
Dr. Hurd, before we dive into iron deficiency amongst Indigenous Australians, can you please give our medical audience a little bit of an idea about your background and your passion for this topic?
I guess I've been in education and general practice my whole career. I'm 40 years graduated these days, so I'm getting on a bit. But the passion really comes from the fact that you go through life and you see various diseases or conditions. And when you come to a new space, I've been down in Central Australia for 7 years now, I've been 30 years in the Territory, and suddenly I'm faced with really extraordinary numbers of people with iron deficiency, anemia. And just wondering how that could be in a rich country like Australia.
And Dr. Hurd, let's set the scene a bit. How do you view the level of iron deficiency amongst Indigenous Australians and the health implications of that condition?
There's two serious health implications. One is in young women who get pregnant and the impact that has on prenatal births and outcomes during pregnancy. And perhaps the more important one, although they're linked to some extent, is iron deficiency in young children under 5 years of age, where there are developmental consequences that, you know, are irreversible and can be very, very important.
And looking across the Indigenous population, how much of a problem is this condition?
Yeah, so if we take the children, we're talking 15% or so. So 15 out of 100 children are deficient in iron and that age group under five. It varies. Screening and treatment have a big impact. And then something similar for probably 10%, where it's very significant in pregnant women. And again, we have pockets, communities where the diet or cultures or whatever really make it more of a problem than it is in some other places. And we might get to talking about the fact that kangaroo meat is probably one of the richest iron sources on the planet, edible iron sources. So it probably comes down to diet largely.
And Dr. Hurd, let's look at the causes of iron deficiency now and the socioeconomic determinants of health and how they affect iron deficiency.
Yeah, well, that's clear. So if you've got to get enough calories into your family so that everybody feels reasonably satiated and it's going to go from day to day and feel okay, then you need a reasonable amount of money to make sure there's enough iron in that diet and some education. There are a few cheap pathways, but, you know, chicken is the cheapest meat and it's also the lowest iron source of any meat. So we see a lot of chicken now in remote communities, fried chicken. It's cheap and easy to prepare. People like the taste of it. So that shift is probably important. The other is just high-calorie industrial foods, things in packets that you open up, are very unlikely to have any iron in them. So poverty is probably the main source of this problem. High-calorie foods, cheap foods, low iron content.
And let's turn to symptoms. What kind of symptoms should general practitioners be looking out for?
So iron deficiency anemia is a slow onset condition. So people can get incredibly anemic over a period of time without presenting. So sometimes we see people in with a hemoglobin of 70, or I think we've been down around 30 in an old fella who just been going on and on and on for years. So if it's slow onset, people adapt. It's a bit like living at altitude or whatever. they kind of seem to get by. So I wouldn't be relying on symptoms in the presentation. Likewise with children, they might get pneumonia, they might be developing a bit more slowly, but if it's got to that point, it's all a bit late. So I think the signs are important. Obviously in adults, just seeing if anybody looks pale, just looking at the conjunctiva, you're going to get an idea. But really all of our clinics are fitted with a place where we can check people's hemoglobin on the spot through a clamp on the finger these days, or a finger prick with a hematocrit measurement. So you've really got to go looking, I would say, if you're going to get a grip on this condition and not wait for symptoms.
And Dr. Hurd, I'd like to ask you about screening. How important is it to actively screen Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples for iron deficiency, and how much screening is happening at the moment?
In the centre, we aim to test everyone at least every 6 months from the age of 6 months. A lot happens in that first 6 months of life. There's hemoglobin, different types of hemoglobin, and it's all changing. Generally, people are relying on their maternal irons that they got during the pregnancy. So from 6 months to 5 years, every 6 months we like to check hemoglobin, and we know exactly the percentage of children that have been checked, and of those, how many have iron deficiency. We keep monitoring that and feeding that back to the clinics all the time. So that group's very important. It's always been recognised in pregnancy as an issue. Iron stores during pregnancy, I don't know if you're aware, it's quite hard to get a grip on iron in our population. Very hard to know the total stores. We've got this idea in mainstream, low ferritin is the signal, so you're measuring iron. Iron might be all over the place, we don't take much notice, we look for low ferritin. The problem is with inflammation, ferritin goes up. So you can be low in iron and have a normal or high ferritin. And in a population with a lot of skin sores or other things going on, you might be really, we might recognize it. And I think the world recognizes we need a simple, straightforward measure of iron, total body iron, and we haven't got it at the moment.
My special guest today is Dr. Sam Hurd, the Medical Director of the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress and an academic GP. And let's turn to treatment. What kind of treatment options would you and your colleagues consider?
I guess the first thing to say is children who are born prematurely, they tolerate oral iron in high amounts and manage it quite well. So something happens when you're iron deficient at birth, you're premature, you actually absorb oral iron pretty well and you do okay. So that's the first bit of treatment, is preventative treatment in prematurely born infants, and that happens regardless. We then go to 6 months when we're responding to anemia. Now, this is hard for some people who come from the East Coast to grapple with, because they don't like giving iron injections in the East Coast. But oral iron isn't effective in our population for various reasons. It can be just regular delivery. It can be because it's not absorbed very well with the other foods. We don't get the vitamin C's and other things that help iron be absorbed. So we use iron injections, and we give 3 iron injections usually over a period of a couple of weeks. But that is given if the hemoglobin drops slightly below normal. So that's why do we do that? Because you're very unlikely to have too much iron on board if your hemoglobin drops a little bit. But we're not treating the anemia. We don't wait for people to get anemic. We treat the iron stores at the first signal that somebody might be short of iron. And we do that parenterally. So that's in children, and we do that up to 5 years of age. After 5 years of age, replacing iron in children is, we can go to oral. There's not a lot of evidence that it makes an extraordinary difference to you with how much iron you've got on board after that. In mainstream, as you know, there's kind of all sorts of concerns about people with low iron who aren't even anemic. And that's, I guess, a different world than we're living in. We really do get concerned again when people get pregnant, or young women who are seeking to get pregnant. And we generally use intravenous iron at that stage. There's a formula for how anemic people are or how low their iron stores are and how much, what their body weight and how much iron we're going to give them. But we give that as, you can just give it as a push, injection, slow push, or you can pop up a little drip and give it over 10, 15 minutes. So that the treatment is fairly straightforward. The acceptance in our community of those treatments is high. And, you know, people generally feel quite a lot better over the weeks after that and are reasonably interested if it crops up again in doing the same thing.
And why is it, Dr. Hurd, that oral iron may not be as effective in the adults that you treat?
It's possibly as effective. It's just that it doesn't make much difference to outcomes unless you're extremely anemic, and in which case you're likely to have sorts of problems. You're generally getting a reasonable amount of iron-rich food, and we spend a fair bit of time helping people understand which foods have iron in them. And, you know, kangaroo meat is obviously a real winner, not so much the tail, which is the most common in town. But iron deficiency is more common out bush than it is in town because of the change in hunting practices, probably. Oral iron, why doesn't it work? People don't like taking it once you're over five. It's pretty unpleasant. It gives you black feces and, you know, it just upsets people's tummy and they're not very keen on it. I think that's probably the main reason. It's hard to know. But again, the evidence for actually giving iron supplements to people who are a bit short of iron in that age group isn't wonderful, not like in young children, pregnant women.
And Dr. Hurd, how much behavioural change are you seeing in people's eating habits and diets, perhaps after they've had some treatment for iron deficiency?
For the reasons of poverty, certainly in children, once you get which Weetabix to buy, which are the foods that have iron in, that can help people quite a lot. Obviously, people who are hunting and having access to meat out bush do fine. But, you know, going way back into the 70s, Professor Max Kamian was a GP out in Bourke, and he managed to get the local bakery to put iron in the bread, and that did wonders for anemia and pretty much got rid of it in the community. But just as putting fluorine into water and fluoride into water and iron into bread and other additives to population's food isn't seen as the thing to do these days. It just makes it a bit more difficult to tackle this. But I think, you know, we've got to find cheaper foods that are readily available that have iron in them. And at the moment, the cheap foods with a lot of calories that people buy don't have much iron.
And finally, Dr. Hurd, on the spectrum of different conditions that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people may be susceptible to, where does iron deficiency rank in terms of seriousness?
Well, I think you'd have to say in the kids, the children, young children, it's got to be very, very high. Given the fact that we've got terrific immunisation program now, we're not seeing nearly so many infective deaths as there were. Meningitis, very much out of the picture these days, luckily. So I think if we're looking at children and making sure they're not disadvantaged, monitoring and treating iron deficiency in children is really extraordinary. And it, you know, protection from infection, it does all sorts of things. Young kids, their brains are just using up 60% of the oxygen in little kids compared to 20% in an adult. And all of that process is dependent on iron, not just the hemoglobin getting it there, but also in the cells that are rapidly metabolizing. So I think we could take that particular aspect, and if we could tackle it through education, nutrition and things, that would be ideal. Until we've got that side of things working, I think the treat early detection and giving iron has to be a very, very high priority. And it is the community, the board, everybody in our community-controlled setting want this to happen.
Dr. Hurd, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure.
My special guest today has been Dr. Sam Hurd, the Medical Director of the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress and an academic GP. This podcast was sponsored by Viatris. You can find more podcasts on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.